From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses the persistent policy and social issues affecting communities of color. I'm your host, Jordan Lawrence, Senior Manager of Communications.
And I'm Kim Atterbury, Senior Director of Communications and External Affairs. And today, we have with us in studio Federal Communications Commissioner Mignon Clyburn, who is the first African-American woman to serve as commissioner and chairman of the FCC. We hope to have the current chairman of the FCC, Chairman Pai, on a later episode. But today, Commissioner Clyburn sits down with us to share her take on FCC issues and policies as she transitions from the FCC into the next stage of her career.
She also dropped some really good gems about what it means to be of public service to people since she's been doing it her entire career. So it's really exciting to hear from her.
Yeah. So what's been going on with you, Jordan?
So I have been down this like Kennedy and presidential history rabbit hole, I guess because it's the 50th anniversary really of, you know, all the big things that happened in 1968. And so CNN had this like really incredible docuseries about the Kennedys. Mm-hmm. It was like a 6-episode long type of thing, and it aired like every Sunday for 6 weeks. But of course, I saved them all on my DVR and then binged them all at once because I am a true nerd. And Netflix just dropped this Bobby Kennedy for President docuseries that really kind of explores how he went from sort of just being the right-hand man to JFK to kind of being thrust into the spotlight. And so it was really incredible. 4 episodes. I watched them all at once also. So yeah, I basically haven't had a life. I've been just sitting around watching documentaries.
So I've kind of been exploring history, but not in the same way. I have been in dogged pursuit of trying to acquire an old historic home that needs rehabbing. So that has been taking up a lot of my free time after work and on the weekends, meeting with contractors, getting quotes, speaking with the owner. It's a lot.
Yes, it sounds like a lot.
to rehab and to flip a house it's a lot of work. It's not as easy as it looks on HDTV.
It doesn't look very easy there either, but I can imagine that time lapses help them move a lot quicker with their process.
Yes, yes. And they have more resources and they have the tried and true contractors, which really is more than half the battle. If you have very talented, reasonable contractors who knows exactly what to do, it makes your life incredibly, it makes the job just so much easier.
But I'm excited for you to find a house, or if it's this house or another one, and so that when you start to rehab, I can put on my Joanna Gaines overalls and come over and like smash down a wall or something.
Oh, definitely.
Get out all my frustrations on like your construction.
Definitely. I will add you to the list of crewmen.
Yes. Put me on payroll.
Well,
you can pay
that.
Me. I kindly accept payment in the form of donuts and Chick-fil-A.
Oh, I can do that.
Yeah.
I can do that. Jordan, before we proceed, I want to clarify that the views and opinions expressed during our podcast are not necessarily those of the National Urban League. Our goal is to simply use this medium as a tool to educate people on social, civil rights, and policy issues. Our hope is that from these conversations that we broker, they will then make informed decisions for themselves. So now a message from Mark H. Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League.
I'm Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment. 50 years ago, just after the death of Martin Luther King, President Johnson signed the Fair Housing Act. Former Vice President Walter Mondale, then a member of the United States Senate, who co-sponsored the bill, recently noted that there's been a struggle to get the Fair Housing Act recognized as real law and enforce it at the state and local level. He said he had little faith that the current administration would aggressively enforce the law. Indeed, earlier this year, we at the National Urban League and other civil rights groups reacted with horror to a decision by HUD Secretary Carson to strike the words inclusive and free from discrimination from the HUD mission statement. Fair housing has been a top priority for the Urban League movement since our founding more than a century ago. Among the 7 objectives outlined in the founding documents of the Committee on Urban Conditions Among Negroes, later renamed the National Urban League, was a focus on housing conditions, employment opportunities, and business development. Urban League programs have helped millions of Americans to prepare for and buy a home, prevent mortgage default and foreclosure, achieve financial literacy and manage credit, and learn how to enforce their rights as tenants and borrowers. It is absolutely impossible to extricate economic justice from fair housing. According to a Harvard University study, moving from a high poverty neighborhood to a low poverty neighborhood raised incomes, improved college attendance, and reduced teenage pregnancy. Zip code can predict life expectancy better than genetic code. That's why the nation must prioritize fair housing. 50 years after the passage of the Fair Housing Act, it's clear that we are not doing enough. In our letter to HUD Secretary Carson, we reminded him of his own words, that he has spoken of the squalid conditions of his childhood neighborhood, and that he, like millions of Black Americans, have experienced firsthand the demoralizing wounds and sting of segregation and racism. On this 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act, we reiterate our call for Secretary Carson to bring his experiences to bear in upholding the duties of his office. Nothing less is expected. I'm Mark Morial, and this has been your To Be Equal moment.
Commissioner Clyburn, thank you for joining us today.
It is my pleasure.
So the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC, is a small but very important government agency that has tremendous oversight on the way we communicate and live. For those who may not know or fully understand, what is the Federal Communications Commission's purpose and function?
The Federal Communications Commission was established by Congress in 1934. It is made up of five commissioners. Three are of the party of the president, and two are in the minority party. And the reason why a lot of people don't hear about the FCC is it's tucked away. It's less than 1,500 employees. But what a lot of people do not realize is that it's responsible for the health and viability of 1/6 of our nation's economy. Mm. And I say that because there is nothing you can do on this planet that is not augmented or supported by a communications platform. So the FCC is responsible for interstate and international communications by wire, by telephone, by radio. And so what in that ecosystem does not touch our lives? And when you think about media and the like, it's a very significant agency that a lot of people don't hear about unless there's some kind of wardrobe malfunction during the Super Bowl, or if somebody has this creative 4 and 5 letter words over the radio, then everybody figures out what the FCC does.
Right.
But on a day-to-day basis, people don't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do things as mundane as, you know, issue telephone numbers, and as significant as either enact or repeal net neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's across the spectrum, literally.
So to put it in real world terms, what's maybe one or two examples of an FCC issue or policy that directly affects people?
I always say that this agency can be an enabler of opportunities or a stifler of opportunities. And the most glaring example to me that is affecting too many people in our community is the FCC's lack or unwillingness to regulate inmate calls in this nation. Now, if you are fortunate, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But there are 2.7 million children who live this existence every day. They have at least one parent that is incarcerated, and they want to stay in touch. They don't stop loving their parents because their parents made a mistake. And what has happened is this system, because of a lack of clarity, a lack of discipline, and a lack of oversight, there is this egregious ecosystem when it comes to the cost of calls to and from facilities, to loved ones, to attorneys, to people who care about and support inmates.
Mm.
And the rates are out of control. It is not uncommon for the cost of a call to be a dollar a minute. There have been costs as high as $14 a minute. Now, if you're a family, you're already economically distressed if a loved one is behind bars.
Right.
Let's just face it, you are more likely to stay clear of that part of it, no matter what mistake you make in this country, if you have money or if you are not as ebony as you and me.
Right.
Let's just face it. That's just the reality. Every stat bears that out. But more importantly to this point, if you've got state and local government, and particularly if you have a federal commission that has been ignoring the calls of individuals who said, you know, look, give me relief, particularly when it comes to interstate race, where we clearly have the authority and we've just done the bare minimum when it comes to that, then our families, our communities suffer. And because of this, only 38% of families who have a loved one behind bars keep in touch with each other on a regular basis. What does that mean? That means that kid that wants to hear or say, I love you, is more likely to act out in school. That means that kid that needs a laptop or broadband connectivity, their parents cannot afford it. That means that grandmother who's taking care of those children, she can't afford to take her meds or can't afford to buy them tennis shoes and the like. These are incredible ripple effects that a lack of attention, oversight, and honestly, compassion from an agency that can do more, that has opted not to do more. Those are some of the, you know, that's the devastating impact on our community. So this agency is more important than you know. It's not just the, you know, let's give somebody a slap on the wrist if they say a curse word or if somebody might have exposed something, you know, on the television. It's way more than that. It really can be either the savior or not of things that are critical in our community. And just think about, I know it's been, you know, not everyone in the public interest and civil rights community, they did not necessarily come out in favor of net neutrality. To me, that's less of an issue. But the thing that is significant about net neutrality, why you hear me being passionate about keeping the rules in place that were just officially repealed back in December, is the fact that think about our history as a people, particularly in with our civil rights struggle. Back in the 50s and 60s, we relied on that telephone to be that gateway to, you know, that rallying cry, to keep let people know what was going on in the movement and across the country. There was an operator on too many on the other side that they were blocking calls. They were, you know, they were ensuring that people were not getting their messages. Fast forward to the day when you have the internet, when you have broadband access, when you have the capacity to just you know, have you ubiquitous contact with people all around the world to get the word out. To, you know, we would not know about Ferguson, but for the internet, because those media outlets were not covering it. They were ignoring it. So when you think about this platform, and when you think about the fact that upwards of 50% of our citizens only have one choice when it comes to a broadband service provider, that's why you hear me talking about why I think net neutrality is so important. Because if you don't have competition, you can't go to another provider if your provider is not treating you right. So I give those two, you know, examples of why this agency is so important, why the policies that they either enact or repeal are so important to our communities. Because there would not be an Insecure on HBO today with, you know, Issa Rae if she did not have the ability to build her brand over the internet with Awkward Black Girl.
Right.
And so those are the realities, the opportunity realities of a free and open internet, of a free and open platform, of just and reasonable rate. If they're unreasonable, if they're unjust, if we can't get to them, then our communities suffer greatly.
I'd like to jump back to the prison phone rate issue for a moment, because I think it's an issue that we can all agree is not getting nearly as much public attention as it should be. How are companies justifying the hike in phone rates when it comes to prison phone rates?
How are they justifying? I really appreciate how you say that. They are justifying it to their shareholders. They are justifying it to their bottom lines. That's how they're justifying it. The people who put out the request for proposals, meaning those facilities, those sheriffs, those you know, those who are responsible for the communications infrastructure, they're justifying by getting a cut of that revenue. That's the justification. It's an economic justification. The sad part is our communities suffer.
And so where are we now on the prison phone rate issue? I know you've been putting in a ton of work on it, but how far have we gotten on trying to make a difference?
Not far at all. The FCC has been silent. The court has ruled not in our favor, but it gave us some runway to do more. We haven't done a thing. There are some bright lights in some state and local communities, but not enough. And so what is happening is, you know, just like the American attention span, you know, something might be hot and heavy one day, but if you're not vigilant, then it goes by the way, you know, wayside. These are the invisible in our community, or they're visible to us. They're really visible to everybody, but they have chosen to ignore these individuals. The number of children who have at least one incarcerated parent in this country is way more than the number of children that are suffering with diabetes. We are all over the map and doing all of these things to address juvenile and diabetes. We're nowhere on the map when it comes to the plight or the fate of these children. I find it really hard to believe that no matter what you think about the incarcerated, that you do not care about the fate of those grandmothers, about those children, those more economically disadvantaged, socially disadvantaged, mentally disadvantaged, mm-hmm. because all of these things have ripple effects. And we just choose to ignore and then wonder why, you know, the incarceration rates, wonder why there's this prison to poverty, why is this hardwired pipeline? Why do we know, and why do these, I call it the bad scientists and planners of the world, when they look at a third grader in a certain community and they figure out how to build a prison? Look, you know, these things that we do or don't do have ripple effects mm-hmm. that can, again, in this case devastate. In other cases, augment if we have good policy. With this, we do not have good policy. We have silence. We're demonizing the inmates. And as a result of demonizing the inmates, we are condemning the families mm-hmm. to poverty, injustice, and lack of opportunities.
What can the public do, if anything, to try to move the needle on this issue in particular?
They can go to their public service commissions in their respective states. They can go to their sheriffs and those who administer those facilities, those jails and those prisons and those facilities. They can go to their lawmakers, their state House and Senate members, and say, do something about this. You can pass laws. You can do all of these things. You can ensure that that the contracts that those sheriffs and others sign are based on the lowest cost provider, not the highest cut that you get. Those are the things that you can do, but you have to be very specific in your ask. You know, we learn this in church. You've got to be very, very specific when it comes to your prayer. This
right.
is when you need to be very specific when it comes to your ask, because if not, change will not happen.
Mm. So you mentioned net neutrality earlier, and so I just want to circle back. For those who may not be familiar with net neutrality, could you tell us what it is and why it matters, particularly to rural, urban, and low-income Americans?
So net neutrality is this concept that on the surface, I don't think anybody would disagree, that all of your data, your access to the internet, your travels, it's all created equal. You know, that those services that you are trying to gain when you go over the internet, that there should not be anybody blocking or slowing down or prohibiting you from access. That if you have a device of your choice that is not harmful to the network, that you should be able to use it in order to gain access to this empowering, enabling platform. And so at its core, no one is going to disagree with that. But what is going on here is the type of regulatory or deregulatory policy posture or footprint we have when it comes to those internet service providers that provision services when it comes to our access. Because internet service providers are our gateway to the internet, mm-hmm. period. Whether you do that by mobile or you know, at your, you know, laptop or at your desktop.
Right.
And so they're the gateways. You're not getting anywhere on the internet without them. And so the big fuss is whether or not a hands-off or a regulatory, I think what we did in 2015 was a regulatory light approach to provide protections to ensure that your experiences, what you pay for is what you get, they protect your private information, because they have access to a lot of things, not just your address, phone number, and some of the other things they might have access. They know what you're doing over the internet. You know, they they're not only the gateway, they're the eyes and ears when it comes to your access over the internet. So they're very powerful. How do they treat you? What are their obligations, you know, when it comes to you? That is at the heart of the debate, whether or not a hands-off deregulatory a posture will enable more investment and opportunities, or rather, and I'm showing my bias, guilty as charged, whether or not a regulatory construct that will allow for innovation and investment at the same time allow for protections and quality of service guarantees and alike. You know, whether or not we achieve that balance. Because I go back to what I said a little earlier. Almost half of us only have one provider. Mm-hmm. We have no choice, you know, when it comes to access over the internet, particularly at home. And when you have that mobile provider, you're in a contract and you're stuck there for a year or two. So when people say that, you know, this is a solution in search of a problem, that you're stifling opportunities, I remind them that, you know, this agency is supposed to strike a balance, a non-discriminatory balance when it comes to our access to those services, advanced communications services at reasonable charges, that it doesn't matter where you live, how much money you have, you know, what you look like, that your access should be the same.
And so I would imagine that depending on regulations, net neutrality could either close the digital divide or bust it wide open, create a wider divide.
So I'm glad
is that true?
I'm glad you added that, because it was a part of your question that I failed to address, is the fact that the one thing about the 2015 rules, which it, and I want to get in the title too, so you're a telecom, you know, geeks out there, we relied on Title II of the Communications Act for the legal justification for our 2015 rules. What doesn't get play is those 2015 rules, that codification of Title II is the basis for what we call a universal service fund. Half of the universal service fund is a part of what we call a Connect America or High Cost Fund. Why that is important, that $4.6 billion? It is providing the economic assistance for telecommunications and broadband providers in rural, RURAL, mm-hmm. communities. I have a southern drawl, so sometimes I have to spell that out. So
I have the same problem.
So yeah, I know. So those non-urban communities that are rural, that those companies will get economic assistance from the federal government. You pay into that. And they are building broadband-enabled infrastructures in rural areas where the business case cannot be made. So if you take away the legal framework that justifies the FCC's ability to do that, then there's going to be someone who might feel like they're harmed, who they can't do business because they said, you know, this favors the incumbents. This favors the, I think I can do a better job. I'm going to sue the FCC mm-hmm. because I don't think they have the legal authority to do what they're doing. And the entire universal service construct when it comes to providing services to rural communities could be at risk. And so that's the part that people don't talk about because, you know, it's a lot of legalese and I'm not a lawyer. So please, I won't bore your listeners with that. But it's a very important mechanism. And it's not just that. The Lifeline program, which a lot of right. urban individuals who are on the wrong side of the economic divide. There are more than 12 million people who have a Lifeline phone that is the difference between them having service or not. They could be at risk because, again, the infrastructure that we've used, we've dispensed with, meaning the majority did, they voted to dispense with in December. Again, this is the legal framework for basically everything that we do to ensure that Americans have connectivity. That is at risk at this point. And that is what you don't hear the majority talking about. Mm-hmm. That is very real. If you ask them to explain how consumers will be protected under this new paradigm, they will not directly answer you because they cannot.
So what can we do? What can the public do regarding net neutrality?
So I say that there is no individual policymaker, lawmaker too small to speak to. Mm-hmm. And here's an example of this. There are two states that passed their own net neutrality laws, and there are others who are promising to do so. There are six states and 30 that are talking about it. They have passed what they call executive orders, which says to those companies that if you don't abide by net neutrality principles, you will not do business in this state. There are 23 attorneys general who have filed against the FCC in its repeal of net neutrality, who say, you know, we think you're on the wrong side of history. We will challenge you. So I say that those entities, plus more, are listening to the people on the ground. So a lot of people look like, well, the FCC did this and the FCC did that. If people hear you on the state and local levels, the state and local levels, they elect members of Congress. Members of Congress, you'll probably hear soon, if you haven't already heard. On the Senate side, they already have 50 votes to put in place what they call a Congressional Review Act, which is basically, you know, saying that the FCC got it wrong, that they vote to say, you know what, we disagree with you. You're on the wrong side of policy history. So we think we should nullify that. Will that pass on the House? Probably not. But it is a sign that that people, lawmakers, are listening. That shows the significance of voices on the ground in the communities being heard. And those are the avenues that people could take if they feel strongly one way or the other.
Okay. As we mentioned earlier, you're the first African-American woman to serve on the FCC and as its chairman, which is a major historic accomplishment. But what our listeners may not know is that you got your start in your home state of South Carolina.
Absolutely.
As a local news publisher and later as commissioner for the South Carolina Public Service Commission. Right. So why did you feel like it was important for you to serve in this particular role?
I think it's important for these boards and commissions to have diversity and inclusion, different points of view. Look, I am obviously a woman. I am obviously African-American. I obviously have a Southern drawl. I think that those points of view and more, you know, I bring perspectives that others do not. You know, I have spent my summers on that dirt road shucking corn and shelling peas and all of those things. And knowing that those people who lived near us, yes, they grew in harvests and had livestock. A lot of that was not by choice, it was by necessity. And so when you see that, I mean, people are making do, but people can do more if their government is has rules and regulations that are targeted to and help and enhance where they are. So my internet technology, media communications, you know, my interaction with it is going to be different from yours, especially if you're from an urban community. My perspective is going to be different from yours, especially if you went to Harvard and Yale. I think it's important to have Harvard and Yale, state, you know, people from state run schools, you know, like me. Those points of views are important because that's the only way to get balanced policies. Mm-hmm. If you have everyone of the same ilk, you're going to have the same ilk when it relates to policies, and it's not going to be applicable or identifiable to me. So that's why it's so important. I am very proud, open almost to a fault, about who I am and whose I am. I think it's important. I'm not ashamed of that. I think it brings perspectives that others do not have. And I think, again, being repetitive, all of that is important when it comes to anything you do, any composition of a board or a committee or the like. It's important to have points of view, different points of view. If you don't, you're not going to address the needs of all that you're charged to serve.
You recently chose to step down from the FCC after 8 years. Why now when there's so much more left to do?
That's a good question that I struggled with for months. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, my term officially ended last June of 2017. And we have this, for me, positive quirk in the law that says that I could serve till Congress adjourns, right, which is December of 2018, or until they appoint and approve my successor. I woke up, and this is literally true, and those of you who are, you know, guided by not only your instincts, but your spirits. I got up a couple of Tuesday mornings and said, today is the time. I've done all that I know I can do to give voice to the voiceless, to promote opportunities for those who've been chronically disadvantaged, to look at some things like we do in auctions and saying, you know what? Only two or three people can take part in this auction to provide wireless services in this nation if we look at a nationwide approach. Why don't we take smaller areas so they can take smaller bites of the auction pie in order to be able to provide opportunities? I've given voice to that. It's never going to be the right time to make a change in your life.
Yeah.
But there's always the perfect time, and this was the perfect time. Because now I think, given the entire landscape, that I can be a better advocate for change in a communication space on the outside.
You've been so key in elevating telecommunications issues that disproportionately affect people of color. What do you hope the commission's priorities will be going forward in regards to communities of color and overall?
I am hopeful that they will elevate the not only the challenges, but the opportunities when it comes to closing the gaps that are, you know, they're not divides, they're canyons, you know, closing these, you know, just wide, disproportionate challenges and gaps when it comes to communication services and opportunities. I am hopeful that they do not, because it looks like they are, that they don't disband or cripple the Lifeline program. Because as it stands now, they're putting these hurdles and these proposals that really would kill the program for those who need it the most. I think if you look at the needs of the people and tailor rules and regulations that will directly address their needs, that will offer more competitive options and opportunities for those who want to do some things different and disruptive, I think that would be positive. Stop ignoring the cries of families who have more than 2 million of the incarcerated. Stop ignoring their pleas, their calls. Stop ignoring it. You know the market is broken. You have acknowledged that the not market is broken. What can you do to be a conduit of change? You can do that, FCC. Stop ignoring the fact and act like we can't see that there are only 12 African-American-owned television stations, full-power television stations in this nation. Is that accidental? I say not. Is that based on, policies? I say yes. And so stop ignoring, this is a horrible saying that I laugh at every time, but it's so appropriate here that one of my old colleagues in South Carolina used to say, kill me by accident or on purpose, the result is the same. Being silent means you're complicit. Doing nothing means you're partly to blame. And so when you see these means of providing opportunities, particularly for those who have been chronically disadvantaged, to sit by and say, I believe in open markets and deregulation, and sit by and think that's okay, it is not. Because I'm going to read one thing here that is very clear in the Communications Act before we run out of time. The FCC is charged with making, quote, available so far as possible to all the people of the United States without discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, or sex, a rapid, efficient, nationwide, and worldwide wire and radio communication service with adequate facilities at reasonable charges. That is an incredible charge that we have that is explicit in the Communications Act. And if we don't take those words literally, we're going to not only have the current divides, we're going to have wider divides. Because now we're talking about 5G and the next generation of technology. There are people without 3G. And you're talking about 5G and going like, oh, we need to be the envy of the world. Absolutely, we do. But there are a lot of people who can't spell world, who don't even know what the world is and what it looks like. And if you don't do anything to try to bridge that gap, to try to address those needs in the communities that need it the most, then shame on you.
And as we draw our conversation to a close, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask what's next for you.
That's a great question that you must have been talking to my mother, who every day is like, have you found a job yet? Have you found a job yet? She is so worried that I'm going to move back home and hang out in her attic. They converted low part of the attic. And I guess I scared her. I'm like, Mom, is the attic clear? Does the air work up there? Look, what I will say to you is, while I can't tell you what my next job title will be, And honestly, probably wouldn't tell you anyway if I knew. Sorry, I like you, but not quite that much.
Yeah.
I will say to you, and then the word will get out really quickly, that I'm going to work on a particular issue that I don't think is getting enough attention, that I am going to continue to be a voice for change and positive disruption in our communities for those who don't have enough advocates when it comes to that. So you will continue to hear me doing and saying and voicing things that mean a lot to me. It might cost me a couple of dollars at the end of the road. But look, even though I will no longer have the title of commissioner, I will still have a voice. I might not have a vote at the FCC, but that I have, I believe, the capacity to continue to do change. So even if you hear about me getting some job, you go like, oh, okay, you know, she might make some money. That's not going to be, that's going to be only one side of the Mignon Clyburn coin.
Okay.
The other side will be, a person continuing to make change and to create opportunities, because I cannot be satisfied. I will not be satisfied but being enriched if I know that someone else doesn't have the opportunity to do so too.
I think that's a great segue to our last question, which is, decades from now, when we look back on the FCC's history and the span of your career, what do you hope your legacy will be?
I hope people will say that in a way in which I could, that I was an enabler of opportunities, that I gave voice to the voiceless, that I looked at people who are on the wrong side or the opposite side of the opportunities divide or debate, and try to do everything in my power to address, give voice, and put policies in place that gave them the oxygen or the fuel that they needed to get to do better, to do more, to be more. Look, was it all perfect? It never is. But every time I woke up, every time I looked at a docket, something I had to vote for, if there was a way for me to push the needle or the envelope to ensure that there are more opportunities for those who have been ignored, I attempted to do so. It might have been a sentence or two. It might have been a footnote or two. But I tried to insert all of that in policy making. As imperfect as it all was, I am satisfied that I lived up to my promise, to my community, that has given me so much. And that's why I can't turn that part of me off. But I hope people would say to me that she tried, she made a difference, and she will continue to do so.
Thank you, Commissioner.
It's been my pleasure.
Each week, we like to shout out an Urban League affiliate that's doing amazing things in the civil rights community and to serve underserved people. Who are we shouting out, Jordan?
This week, we're shouting out the Knoxville Area Urban League for celebrating 50 years of service. Since 1968, the Knoxville Area Urban League has provided exemplary service to the people of Knoxville, Tennessee, and surrounding areas. Under its current CEO, Phyllis Nichols, the Knoxville Urban League has grown to serve 8,200 individuals and families each year through its 24 programs. Congratulations on 50 years of service. We can't wait to see what you all do for the next 50.
Yay! As always, you can follow us on all social media at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy teams here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to the National Urban League's For the Movement.